The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
As Linda said, this is the last week of our series on the precepts. This week, I'll be talking about the fifth precept, the precept on refraining from intoxicants. And just as a kind of an overview or refresher, I'll just name the other four, too, that we've been talking about. Refraining from killing living beings, refraining from taking what is not given, refraining from sexual misconduct, refraining from false speech, and refraining from intoxicants. Those are the five precepts that we've been talking about this series. So last week, in talking about refraining from false speech, we also talked a little bit about more generally being aware of our speech and taking care with our intention in speaking. And I wanted to just see if anybody had any questions or comments or anything they'd like to just share with people about anything they noticed with this in this last week, if anybody had been working with this. Okay, we can just move on then. So this week, I'm going to talk first about the fifth precept, and then a little bit more generally about working with the precepts in our lives and how to work with the inevitable fact that we will end up not being able to follow them all the time. So working with having broken the precepts, with making amends, with working with forgiveness. So a lot of different practices along those lines. So this fifth precept, the Pali for this precept refers explicitly to alcohol, to distilled and fermented liquors. But it also uses the phrase intoxicants. So the interpretation of this precept is that in general it refers to any kind of intoxicant that we might take into our body. And it's helpful to think of that in these days, since there's so many different kinds of intoxicants that we can choose to ingest. So this precept, I think, refers to any of those kinds of intoxicants, to refrain from taking them into our bodies. Now, the precept is worded in such a way that it's a little bit ambiguous, and some people interpret it in different ways. So some people interpret it to mean not that you can't take a glass of wine, for instance, but that you don't drink to the point of intoxication, or that you don't take these things to the point of intoxication. So, you know, I'm going to leave it for you to work with this in your own way, to think about it in your own way. But there's a lot of different views on this particular subject. So, but it's an interesting area to explore. Why is it that we take in intoxicants? What's the point of that? What is the reason? I mean, I think a lot of us take a little bit of alcohol to relax us in a group. Or perhaps we take some alcohol because we want to numb a feeling. So what's the purpose? What's the point behind taking in intoxicants? So looking at that as a part of the exploration for this precept. This precept is a bit different than the others. The first four, refraining from killing living beings, refraining from taking that which is not given, refraining from sexual misconduct, refraining from false speech, directly relate to how we behave with other people. It has to do with not harming other people in a very direct way. But this fifth one is different. It doesn't really, you can drink or take intoxicants without harming other people. Now, whether or not it harms yourself is another matter. But so it's got a different quality to it than the other four precepts. And in fact, in the suttas, in the Pali texts, it's dealt with in a different way also. So the first four are very much embedded in the whole of the practice. There's the teaching on the Eightfold Path, which I'm sure most of you have heard of. There's the aspect of right speech, right action, right livelihood, which comprises the ethical component of the Eightfold Path. And the first four precepts fall directly under right speech and right action. This fifth precept is not really in there. There's also another teaching, a very famous teaching on right view or right understanding, which covers 10 wholesome and 10 unwholesome courses of action. And again, these first four precepts are covered in this list of what is unwholesome and what is wholesome. How do we behave in an unwholesome way or a wholesome way? So those first four are covered in that list of 10 ways of acting. And again, this fifth precept is not in that list. This precept is pretty much only found, this refraining from intoxicants is pretty much only found in this list of the five precepts or the eight precepts or the 10 precepts. The eight precepts are the they're precepts that are often taken by lay observers when they go to a monastery. In Asia, there are weekly observance days where lay people will go to the monastery and spend a day at the monastery. And they will take on eight precepts during that time. And the additional three precepts aren't so much about ethical conduct as they are about renunciation. They're about refraining from eating after noon, refraining from sleeping in high and luxurious beds, refraining from entertainment, adornment, and beautification. So they're not so much about non-harming, it's more about renunciation for the time that you're in the monastery. But the first five precepts are part of those eight precepts. The 10 precepts are precepts often taken by nuns. And they include some additional constraints on behavior that make it much more of a renunciate monastic lifestyle. It takes the precept on, I think it's on entertainment, beautification, adornment, beautification and entertainment, and splits it into two precepts, and then adds the precept of not handling money. So that one extra precept makes a huge leap in terms of the difficulty of working with that precept. So these five precepts, though, are kind of the ground, the base of all the precepts. So this fifth precept is found in all of these precept lists, but it's pretty much, I think, not found anywhere else. So it's got a different flavor to it. Another aspect, just to clarify a little bit around this precept, because some people think about, well, if it means any kind of drug, then what do I do about medication? And it's not meant to include medication. So medication like, you know, NyQuil has alcohol in it, and pain medications may have a kind of a slight intoxicating experience to them. But that's okay. I mean, it's not meant to include medication here. Also, some people ask about, well, what about alcohol and cooking? And again, you know, that's not in commentaries I've read, modern day commentaries I've read, that's again not an issue. The benefits of working with this precept, really, what this precept is really about, if I look at the intention behind the precept, the full statement of the precept is, I undertake the precept to refrain from intoxicants which lead to heedlessness. So the point behind it is really the fact that we're trying to promote heedfulness. We're trying to promote awareness, clarity of mind. If you are interested in promoting clarity of mind, then refraining from intoxicants is a good idea. I'll tell you a story from my own practice on this. I used to love to drink wine, and when I started my meditation practice, I would, you know, sometimes go out to dinner at night and have a glass of wine with dinner. And pretty quickly, after starting my meditation practice and engaging in the sitting that I was doing, I was enjoying sitting. I was enjoying the experience of the meditation and enjoying the clarity of mind that came with the sitting. And I like to sit twice a day, so I sat morning and evening. And I found that after I'd had a glass of wine with dinner, I couldn't really sit at night. And not only that, I found that the sitting the next morning was pretty foggy. And so pretty quickly, for me at least, I valued the clarity of mind in the meditation over and above the pleasure I got out of the wine in the evening. So it was not easy, I would say, completely easy to give it up. But it was a natural movement of mind for me. It wasn't something I had to struggle with because I so much valued the clarity in the meditation. So that's my own exploration of it. And it ended up being something that, for me at least, was not terribly hard to let go of. The hardest time for me came when I went to visit my family, because I had a kind of a shared enjoyment around fine wine with my father. You know, we enjoyed, you know, doing taste tests of the different wines. And that, I felt like, was a lovely way that we connected. And I missed that. I missed that experience. So that was the hardest place to work with this precept, was when I went to visit my family. So exploring this precept is primarily, I think, about exploring clarity of mind. What do you appreciate about your mind? Is there a way in which having a clear mind is something that you appreciate? Now, I know that sometimes having a clear mind is not something we appreciate. I mean, we don't particularly want to see what's going on in our minds. We would rather numb it out. We'd rather not be there for our experience. But I'd like to suggest that the way through those kind of difficult experiences is the clear knowing of them. That only actually through the clear knowing of some of the pain or sorrow or sadness or grief, only through the clear knowing of that will it actually have a chance to really flow and move through us and out of us. And that kind of numbing that happens with intoxicants can kind of block that process of the allowing these emotions to flow through us. There's a Thai teacher who had, there's a couple of stories from a Thai teacher that I'd like to share with you. This is Tan Jeff's teacher, Thanissaro Bhikkhu. He comes up here about once a year to teach with us. And these quotes are from his teacher, Ajahn Phuong, from the book Awareness Itself, which is one of those free books that's sometimes out on the table out there. So there's two stories about this fifth precept. A young man was discussing the precepts with Ajahn Phuong and came to number 5, against taking intoxicants. He said, "The Buddha forbade alcohol because most people lose their mindfulness when they drink, right? But if you drink mindfully, it's okay, isn't it? And the teacher replied, if you were really mindful, you wouldn't drink it in the first place. So that's an interesting thing to contemplate. Again, it gets to that question of why do we drink? You know, what is the motivation? What is the underlying reason? So looking at that, exploring it. I mean, I'm not saying, you know, in all of these precepts, actually, I'm not saying, you know, take these on and, you know, forever live, you know, never breaking these precepts. What I'd like to encourage with this is an exploration of all of these precepts, an exploration of what is your relationship to them and what is your mind doing around them. So if you choose to have some alcohol, look at your motivation. Look at what's the underlying reason for it. Be mindful of it. Now, if you are really mindful, according to Ajahn Phuong, you will probably put the alcohol down. We'll see. The second story is another student came. One evening, another student was conversing with Ajahn Phuong at the same time that a group of people were sitting around them in meditation. I can't observe the fifth precept, he said, because I'm under a lot of group pressure. When we have social occasions at work and everyone else in the group is drinking, I have to drink along with them. Ajahn Phuong pointed to the people sitting around them meditating and said, this group isn't asking you to drink. Why don't you give in to their group pressure instead? So just a way of thinking, exploring this precept. Now again, pushing the boundaries of the precept a little bit, it's interesting to look at other ways that we intoxicate our minds, other than through actual ingesting an intoxicant. Television, for example, especially certain kinds of television, or gambling, a kind of addiction that intoxicates the mind. Sometimes junk food can be an intoxicant, a way of polluting the body, and almost can be an addictive quality to a way that we take in junk food. The internet, that's a really a new one for us, and it's easy to get hooked in surfing the internet in stuff that's just like, you know, why am I looking at this anyway? There's many, many things that serve to dull the mind and keep us out of the present moment. So again, if you find yourself engaged in mindlessly spinning the channel, spinning the dial, or surfing the internet when you're not really, you know, it's just kind of like pulled on to the next thing, there's kind of this wanting for something to satisfy us. We just keep hoping the next internet page will be something that is something really great and dulls our mind out for a few minutes so that we can enjoy ourselves for a few seconds. So what is the motivation? What are we doing? Just wake up to what we're actually doing in our lives. So before I move on to working with the precepts more generally, I just want to, there's kind of a, you know, a nice breaking point here. I just wanted to check in and see if there's any thoughts or comments about this precept, anything you're interested in exploring around this precept, anything anybody have to offer or say. Yeah.
During my lifetime, I got intoxicated a few times. I can almost count. A couple of weddings here and there, a couple of social gatherings. It just happened. But I found that when I did that, I became very, very, how do you say it? I had loving and kindness in me that came out in me.
Mm-hmm.
And to the point of tears. Sympathy, understanding, love. And correspondingly, I do know a few people where, if they get intoxicated, they get very mean. So it's almost like a truth serum. You know, I don't know what it is. But I could not do it. I could not express that feeling I had until I got intoxicated. And not that I got intoxicated for that reason, but when I did it, the result was that.
Mm-hmm.
The loving kindness came out.
That's very interesting. So, I think you're right. There could be a kind of a... What the alcohol, I think, does is it loosens social convention or ways in which we have built up barriers around ourselves. And if we've built up barriers around loving kindness and compassion and connection, that might be what in fact is revealed as we open those barriers. So that's a very interesting point.
Would that also apply for the people or whatever that turn mean, the barriers in that sense? I don't know what it is, but you know, they really get mean.
I know that with some people, it's almost a physical reaction to the alcohol. That it's not so much that it's uncovering the way they truly are, like you said, a truth serum, but it's actually some reactivity of the body almost. There's a culturally, I was in the Peace Corps in a country called Vanuatu, and people there, when they got drunk, they just really couldn't handle their alcohol, and things got extremely rowdy and very violent if people got drunk. And it seemed to be something in the genetic makeup of, you know, the body. So I don't know that I would necessarily say that it's, you know, always, you know, covering something that is repressed, but that some people potentially just can't tolerate the alcohol, really, in a sense, in their bodies.
Thank you. There's an enzyme called alcohol dehydrogenase, and it's produced at different quantities in different races.
So, and it allows you to metabolize the alcohol or something?
Yes. Alcohol is a poison to the body, and the liver actually goes through the process of breaking down alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an evolutionary adaptation when we ate fermented food, so that's why we have that enzyme.
I see, yeah.
So we at some point do consume alcohol when we eat fermented foods.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that when we do consume alcohol, some people can break it down, some people can't. The other aspect is it affects certain centers of the brain. So that's where emotion regulation could be affected.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I figured that in this community we'd have someone who actually knew the sort of biochemical. This is actually a really interesting topic. I'm the child of a recovering alcoholic who's been recovering since I was 8, and has been very active in AA, which is a mindfulness practice in and of itself that draws on a lot of the precepts of Buddhism. And I'm one of four. My siblings and I have all, in our adult lives, kind of found our ways to various forms of mindfulness practice. And while only my youngest brother abstains from alcohol entirely, I think we're all very conscious of, you know, and throughout our lives have always been very conscious of when we consume, why we consume, and how it makes us feel. And I noticed, it was interesting, I noticed last Thursday I was here and left feeling truly euphoric. It was a wonderful, wonderful feeling. And I was at the airport taking the red eye to New York and hadn't had dinner, whatever, so I went and sat in like the Perry's or something like that, had a glass of wine, and immediately felt it bring down that euphoric feeling. Like it was instantaneous. And so I was wondering what the biochemical...
He said it's a depressant. A depressant.
Yeah, alcohol is a depressant. So after you drink, you will feel it down. So it's the genetics is very interesting in it. I've really been interested in the intersection between meditation and neuroscience. And so there's a lot of interesting work being done in that area.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's a great thing to observe. You don't actually have to know the biochemical reason. Just notice that that happened. And, you know, if you're feeling that way, know that if you would like to stay feeling that way or allow that to live its own life, that ingesting alcohol will probably not be the thing to do. That's a beautiful story. Thank you. Yeah, over here. And this will be the last one before we move on.
Obviously, the topic is alcohol, but clearly there is a large portion of the population that also smokes marijuana. So I'd like you to talk about that, and I'm also curious to hear what you have to say about that. Because just from, I'm in the nutrition industry, and so I could talk to you all day long about that sort of thing. But I come from a family of people who smoke marijuana, and I myself do not. But I have a similar experience as her in how that's affected my life and becoming aware and conscious of people around me who may also smoke or, you know, do alcohol or anything. I think that that's something that definitely you should speak about and not just limit it to alcohol, because it's a lot of people do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I broadened it to intoxicants, I was including marijuana, ecstasy, LSD, anything that alters the mind could be considered an intoxicant. So, yeah, absolutely. They alter the ability for the mind to really stay clear and present. And that's what we're really cultivating in mindfulness practice. And the joy, essentially, that we get from clarity of mind. Now, we may not always experience it initially, but over the course of time in our practice, we will start to feel the benefits of being present. And that kind of clarity to presence is something that these intoxicants, marijuana included, will take the edge off. It won't allow us to be quite so present. Now, I think one of the reasons why we engage in intoxicants, why we take them in, is because we are so repressed in our culture that it's kind of a way of loosening up and allowing ourselves to feel things that we don't often feel, as in your story, the feelings of love coming through with the taking of the alcohol. But as we practice, I think we find that a lot of those same kinds of repressions begin to be loosened as we do our meditation practice. So the clarity of mind that we get with the meditation can actually serve to heighten our senses and make us happy and relaxed and at ease in a way that intoxicants really can't, actually.
The one thing I've noticed is that when I exercise, after exercise, I meditate, I find that it's far easier to go into relaxation mode.
After you exercise. Yeah, for some people that's true, I think. You know, it can do something to the body that allows it to settle. So it generates endorphins, exercise, so.
And also your muscles are all relaxed. It's because they've already been used.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I can definitely agree. I take blood pressure quite often with people after they've exercised, and it's often that their blood pressure will be much more normalized and lower after exercise.
Mm-hmm.
So they're way more relaxed, way more able to go into a more meditative state. You know, if you took the same person who take their blood pressure on a regular basis, and if they're not exercising, it would be totally different.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like we could keep going on this topic for a while, but I do want to move on a little bit. So thinking about working with these precepts in general, You know, it's come up several times over the course of the 5 weeks about how to work with it if we find ourselves having broken a precept. We often think that if we commit to a precept, I mean, maybe it's from our societal upbringing, our cultural norms, that if we say, I vow to do X, that it means that, you know, if we don't follow through, that we're a bad person and we like flog ourselves for not fulfilling our commitment and then think, well, I obviously can't do this, so forget about it. And that's not the way that at least I work with the precepts. I really think of them as living experiences, almost more like mindfulness bells, you know, reminders to myself to pay attention. If something, I see that I might be engaging in a behavior of twisting the truth a little bit, it's like, wake up, what am I doing? Why? What's the motivation? What's the intention? So it becomes a way of reflecting on experience. Not so much a thou shalt not, but more of a looking at it, working with it as training rules, which is what the term precept means. So it's a commitment. When I think of taking the precepts, I look at it as a commitment to work with them, a commitment to explore them with integrity. And it does mean that we also need to work with what happens if we find ourselves slipping into lying or engaging in some kind of overtly sexual relationship that maybe wouldn't be such a good idea, or perhaps taking something from work that we aren't really offered from our work. So looking at how do we work with it once we have actually broken the precepts? I'm going to go back to point to the sutta that the Buddha talked to his son about working with reflecting on our experience. And just to remind you, he said that before any action of body, speech, or mind, reflect on is this harmful or non-harmful to myself or another person. During any action of body, speech, or mind, reflect on is this action causing harm in the moment to any either myself or another person. If it is, stop from doing it. And then again to reflect afterwards, have I done anything that's caused harm to any person through an act of body, speech, or mind? So he really encourages reflection. He encourages this looking back at our experience to see how have I behaved? Have I done something that's caused harm? And can I work with that? Can I change my behavior around it? This teaching is actually broader than the precepts. It's much broader than the precepts. But it's helpful to think about with respect to the precepts of how do we work with this reflection? It can be a little bit daunting at times to look back on our experience and say, okay, I'm going to reflect back and think about, have I hurt anybody? Have I done something wrong? You know, some of us have the habit of looking back over our experience. I have this kind of mind that goes back over my experience, trying to find things I've done wrong just so I could beat myself up about it. And I've had to learn to be very careful about how I let my mind reflect over my experience. Because when it's looking back over my experience with the intention towards creating guilt for myself, it's not so skillful. So it's helpful to... there's one teacher who teaches an actual kind of form around doing this reflection. She says she teaches this. This is a teaching from Annie Nugent, who's one of the teachers at IMS, and she teaches also at the Forest Refuge in Massachusetts. She teaches the four R's. Relax. So that's the first thing. She even suggested getting in the tub, you know, really relax. Have it be a kind of relaxing thing that you do when you're going to reflect. The second is reviewing. Reviewing your day or reviewing the past few days. What's been going on? So in a relaxed state, just review, kind of in a very hopefully neutral, non-judgmental way. How have you been interacting with people? And reflect on those interactions. The third R, reflecting. Reflect on, has it been skillful or unskillful? And then if you notice that there has been some unskillful behavior, the fourth R is resolve. The resolve to make amends, to change your course of action. So to make it a kind of a almost a ritualized form in terms of this reflection. That might be helpful for some of you. So in terms of actions, when we have caused harm, when we have not behaved so skillfully, there's different ways in which to work with this. In the monastic world, I'll just put this out there because it gives you a sense of how the Buddha set up his for his monks a kind of a ritualized regular event to deal with this, to deal with the fact that we said skip book. Now the monks deal with 227 precepts. And the fully ordained nuns deal with 311 precepts. So there's a lot of things that could, you know, besides these basic, the basic five ethical conduct precepts that they might have to confess about having, you know, let their robes slip onto the ground or eaten out of an alms bowl that wasn't properly washed or whatever. You know, there's many, many different rules they follow. But in any case, the Buddha set up twice monthly a time when the community came together to share confession with another monk, not in front of the whole community, but just individually with another monk, sharing a confession. And then coming together as the community to retake the precepts together. So I think that's an interesting form. You know, the fact that it happens twice a month gives you a sense that there's a kind of a regular processing of the conduct, and that it's not, you know, it's not necessarily it doesn't have to be a confession to the world. It can be a confession to just another trusted person. Another person that you really trust. Somebody you value their advice, you value how to what they have to say. So bringing that piece in, it doesn't have to be a big deal in terms of, quote, confession. It's more of a sharing of, gosh, I did something that I don't really feel good about. I'd like to talk about it. And then the retaking of the precepts. Now, this is actually, it's actually, for me at least, more important than I realized. This kind of regular, just reminding myself, this is the set of guidelines that I aspire to live my life by. This is the aspiration of how I'd like to live my life. I don't want to harm people. So this is the way I'd like to conduct myself. And to remind myself of that regularly, it helps to make it more conscious in my day. So the Buddha recommended this twice a month process. I know some people who do this every day. They take the precepts every morning. And one woman says it really helps her, partly because she sees that it's kind of like, okay, I've got this day, and then I get to take them again tomorrow. You know, it's like, I don't have to say I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. I don't have to say I'm going to be perfect for the rest of my life. It's just this moment, this day, this engaging right now. In terms of retaking the precepts, I had a very clear experience on how helpful that was during one retreat that I was on when I, in an interview, said something that wasn't quite true. And realized that I needed to tell the teacher, but there was a couple days before I had a chance to see the teacher again, and I did retake the precepts, but I still found my mind keeping going out and reviewing this incident and beating myself up about it over and over and over again. And finally, when I got to the teacher, I talked to him about it. And he just said, well, all you need to do is retake the precepts. And I said, well, I've done that. And he said, well, take them in front of me. So I did. I verbalized the precepts in front of him. And at the end of that, he said to me, now your sila is completely purified. Meaning now your ethical, your ethics are clear. Your morality is clear. And that to me was a very interesting teaching, because it really showed me that the intention in that moment, that's where to focus on, you know, how we're moving forward. How we've behaved in the past, we have to really let that go and just engage. Okay, this is where I want to move forward from. This is my aspiration. So it was very helpful to me to hear him say that. To remind me that it's the aspiration in the moment that makes us, that really supports our ability to engage with these precepts. So sometimes also we might need to make amends. And this, you know, this is different for different people. Sometimes we can't make amends. Sometimes it's not possible. Either the person that we would like to make amends with is no longer here, or some other circumstance we're not able to make amends. But it is sometimes helpful to make amends if we really feel like we've harmed somebody. Or that even there's been the possibility of harming somebody, if we've said something that we feel might have caused some harm, to go and say, gosh, I'm really sorry. I hope that this isn't too painful, and I would like to apologize. You know, so making amends can be a good way also to let go of the guilt and the beating ourselves up. You know, that kind of regret that we have when we've harmed somebody, the guilt, actually, is not so helpful. It's not such a helpful emotion. We think it is in some way. It's almost like we feel like when we've hurt somebody that we deserve to beat ourselves up because we've hurt somebody, so we have to be hurt ourselves also. It's kind of like it's kind of a justification we feel like, or we feel like, you know, we don't deserve to feel good because we've hurt somebody. But according to the Buddhist teachings, this kind of guilt is not actually a skillful emotion, because it compounds aversion with the experience. We're actually averse to what's happened. It's not simply a simple acknowledgement of, yes, this has happened, this is the result. So in our looking at how we respond when we've hurt somebody, there may well be sadness. There may well be a sense of remorse, of a feeling of, I really feel like that was not a good thing to have done. And it may not feel so good. Now that aspect of it, that aspect of simple remorse, is actually skillful. But it's kind of a fine line for us when for remorse can move into that kind of guilt, that feeling of flogging ourselves. Remorse can be a way of saying, I've caused somebody harm, and it's like this. This is the way experience is when that has happened. if we can come into a purity of remorse or a purity of sadness, it can feel, it doesn't feel quite so constricted. It doesn't feel quite so angry at ourselves. It's more of a sense of, there's a softer feeling to it. So that, you know, see if you can tell the difference between remorse and that guilt. Just seeing if you can notice the different flavors. Sometimes when we, even after we've, if we can't make amends, or even after we've made amends, there's still, if there's still some kind of remaining feeling of either remorse or sometimes even of guilt, sometimes it can be helpful to take some kind of an action, almost a ritual, to help work with the feelings. And there's a story about this. Some of you may have seen it. It's in The Inquiring Mind. Jack Kornfield tells the story, and he published it in The Inquiring Mind this month. And it's a story about a person who on retreat uncovered or felt an incredible sense of remorse and guilt about something he had done when he was a teenager, even younger. I think he was between the ages of 8 and 14. His father forced him to shoot 16 dogs because they were stray dogs on the property. His father forced him to shoot the dogs. And this had been weighing on him for years. And during this retreat, he was having a great deal of trouble focusing in concentration and was actually experiencing like he had a werewolf inside of him that wanted to eat him up. And when this story came out, Jack suggested that he have a ritual, that he create a ritual around a healing for this this circumstance. And I'll read you what he did. Over the next few days, he chose a hillside site near the retreat center and carefully formed a circle of 16 stones, one for each of the dogs that so weighed upon his conscience. Then one evening at dusk, we headed up the hill together. The stars were becoming visible. Bruce showed me that the largest stone was oriented north towards Sirius, the dog star, in honor of the dog's undying spirits. At the base of each stone, he placed a written prayer of atonement, and in the center, he placed a small stone next to one of the largest. This, he told me through his tears, was the puppy of a dying mother who had tried to shield her even in the last moments after she was shot. These were the last dogs he had killed. We meditated in the evening stillness. He bowed, lit candles, offered prayers, and spoke to these dogs about what his heart had learned and how their spirits would teach him for the rest of his days. But he was not yet free. He felt the dogs wanted something from him. He wanted to make atonement. Bruce decided to pledge $5,000 for animal welfare, and to always keep a dog, and to work half a day each month in the nearby animal shelter for 10 years. This, he felt, would be a labor of love. I saw Bruce 6 months later. He told me that his healing work was as challenging as ever, but he felt better. I could see it. His whole spirit seemed to have lightened up, his body relaxed. So sometimes we need to, in this case, there wasn't a particular way he could directly atone to the animals. But the ritual helped open up his emotions around the experience, and he took some steps forward in terms of taking some action. So if there's something that weighs very heavily on you, consider seeing if you could create a ritual. Sometimes this happens for us after a parent dies, that we feel like some kind of atonement or work needs to be healed. Pain needs to be healed after a parent dies. So consider a ritual around that, working with healing some of those things. The last piece I'll bring in around this is forgiveness practice. This is a practice that's often taught in conjunction with the love and kindness practice that we teach. And it's helpful with respect to harming, because we feel like we've harmed somebody else. We may feel like we need forgiveness from them. We also may feel like we need to forgive ourselves. So this forgiveness practice, forgiveness is really an internal process. It's not, especially if we're forgiving somebody who has harmed us, you know, that aspect of forgiveness, sometimes we can resist because we feel like if we forgive them, it means we're forgiving what they did. It means that we're saying that what they did was okay. And that's not what forgiveness is actually about. Forgiveness is about letting go of the pain in ourselves. It's about letting go of the holding on to the resentment around an action. It's not about saying, oh yes, you could do that again, no problem. One person, I don't know where this comes from, it's a beautiful definition of forgiveness though. It's forgiveness means giving up all hope of a better past. So that's the way to think about forgiveness, that it's letting go of things, the wrongs done to us in the past, and moving forward without carrying that burden with us. So the practice of forgiveness is a fairly formal one, and it's got three parts to it. There is this part of it's done in statements. So you bring to mind, the first part of it is bringing to mind a person or people who you feel like you have caused harm to. So bringing them into your mind and then saying the phrase to yourself, for any harm that I have caused you, intentionally or unintentionally, I ask for your forgiveness. So it's a kind of like almost visualizing the person and saying that phrase while keeping in mind the way in which you may have harmed that person. The second part of it is around forgiving ourselves. So bringing up any things we may have done to ourselves, saying the phrase, for any harm I have caused myself, intentionally or unintentionally, I forgive myself. This can be quite powerful, actually, this forgiving ourselves for the way we have behaved, for harm that we've caused ourselves. The third part, and this is usually the most difficult, is for people who have harmed us, to offer forgiveness to people who have harmed us. So bringing to mind somebody who may have harmed us and saying the phrase, and I'll give you several variations on this phrase. For any harm that you have caused me, intentionally or unintentionally, I freely forgive you. Now, that can be difficult at times. It can sometimes feel like we cannot freely forgive somebody for a harm they have caused us, that we are still holding on a little bit, and saying that I freely forgive you is tantamount to lying. So there are some other phrases that you can play with. One is, to the extent that I'm able, I forgive you. Another is, if you feel like there's just no way you can even contemplate forgiving the person at the moment, is, I hope to be able to forgive you someday. That you express the wish that forgiveness might be possible. Even that is moving in the direction of forgiveness. Even if you're not able to do it now, to simply express the wish that you might be able to forgive. So this forgiveness practice can be quite helpful not only around the precepts, but in general in our practice for ways in which we have been harmed or harm others. So we're at the end of our evening, and I'd hoped to chant the precepts again tonight, but since it's already 8:59, we don't really have time for that. So I'll end by simply expressing that if there's any way in which I have harmed you or caused you pain, intentionally or unintentionally, in these 5 weeks, I ask for your forgiveness. Thank you.